What is up, everyone? Welcome back to another episode of the Babbles Nonsense podcast. I am beyond excited for today's guest. Her name is Dr. Jessica Hissom. If you do not know her, I feel like you should know her. And hopefully by the end of this interview, you will walk away wanting to know more about her and her cause. She is a deaf advocate, public policy specialist, executive director of Center of Advancement of Next Gen Deaf, which is a nonprofit organization that advocates for the deaf community, their families, and professionals who care for them. She also has a doctorate in physical therapy, where she focused on pelvic health, sexual trauma, and so much more. In this interview, she teaches me all about how she was born deaf, how she was misdiagnosed at an early age, the importance of the neurobiological window with the development of language, and how important it is for pediatric hearing screening. We also discuss the deafness spectrum and discrimination within the deaf community, and how we can all educate ourselves to become advocates for the deaf community. So without further ado, let's just dive on into the interview and welcome Dr. Jessica Hissom to the show. Babbles Nonsense podcast. I am beyond excited to have Dr. Jessica Hissom here today. Not only is she a deaf advocacy and a public policy specialist, but I found out a little bit about her background yesterday, and she's also a physical therapist that specialized in pelvic health, sexual trauma, and all of that. So we got a lot to unpack here.
We do.
So I'm so excited that you're here. Kristen Bernard, actually from Coats de Femme, is the one who pointed me in the direction of your pod, yes, or your Instagram, because I had not heard about you. And she was like, go look at this girl's Instagram and tell me what you think. I think she would be perfect for your podcast. And as soon as I started listening to yourself, I was like, oh my God, I have to have her on.
Well, thank you. I'm honored. And thank you to Kristen too. She's a very dear friend. I've enjoyed getting to know her when I did some work with her too.
She's sweet. I love her. I've had her on. So obviously, we got to start from the very beginning. Yes. So, guys, this podcast, and I've already told Jessica, if I say anything that could become or sound offensive, it's literally just my ignorancy. And I want her to correct me because I'm not trying to offend anyone. I'm really trying to learn more about the deaf community. And just because I am a nurse practitioner does not mean that I have been taught how to learn or navigate this. So I'm actually very excited to learn and navigate this being in the healthcare field. So we were talking earlier, you said you were actually born deaf.
Yes, I was born deaf. So I was born with bilateral sensory neural, profound severe hearing loss. And I really wanted to hit a point, and I absolutely agree with you. That's one of the things I see as a healthcare provider and now policy specialist on the flip side. We don't treat hearing loss as emergency and urgent, just like the way if you start losing your vision, it's automatically urgent. Like we start to figure out why you're losing your vision and stuff. And we don't treat hearing loss the same way. So I think that's part of the medical model in general, that we just don't educate well enough. We brush over it. And like I even remember we brushed over it in physical therapy school when I was getting my doctorate.
Right.
And technically, it's not my scope of practice. I get that. But I think it's because, quotation marks, not in your scope of practice to know about hearing loss, because people defer to an ENT or a audiologist who works with a physician, you know. So I think it's really interesting that you bring that up. And
well, all we learned was like you said, there's sensorial and then I forget the other one. There's like two different types.
There's sensorial, there's conductive, and there's mixed. And there's another category, but I can see the word and I'm not going to be able to say it.
But we learned it in the sense of like, here's the different types of hearing loss. And since I'm acute care and gerontology, okay, we learned about it for the geriatric population, not the pediatric population. So since you were born deaf, how did your mom know there was something wrong? Like, when did she realize?
So, and that's really interesting that you bring up, because when I was born, so I was born in 1993, I'm 30, and newborn hearing screening actually was not mandated at the time. It actually didn't really get mandated till 2000, which
that's
is
so
when
crazy.
My sister was born. I know, but you don't think about how far along we've come, but how yet far we got to go. So for my mom, and it's one of the things that I see over and over again, is a mom's intuition is really good.
Yes.
And
yes.
So for her, for me, I was very responsive to touch and to light and stuff. But she, for example, would put me on the floor with my toys and stuff, be like, I'll be right back. I'm going to go grab something in my room. And I would freak out. And at first she was trying to figure out, and she would call me from her room like, Jess, I'm still here. Like, I'm okay. Like, you're okay. I'm coming back, you know? And she started to pick up on different little cues, but that's one of the stories that she shared with me. And she started to suspect that I did have hearing loss just based on, especially that first 3 months postpartum when she had me and was raising me with my dad. But she was the main caretaker of our home. So there were just little hints for her. So she took me to the pediatrician. And like I said, newborn hearing screening was not a thing yet. So she was like, I think this child has hearing loss. Like, I need a hearing screening. And he's like, and what he would do as a pediatrician, which is what a lot of providers do, is the clap test.
Yeah, I've seen that.
You've seen that. But if you think about it, if you do a clap test where you clap your hands behind a child.
Oh, I thought you were talking about the side.
It's from behind.
Okay.
So think about if you clap from behind, you got the wind.
Yeah.
So
well, and you're like you say, if you, I don't know because I haven't had any issues, but like they say, if you lost your vision, lost your hearing, your other senses are heightened. So your sense of touch probably was more heightened anyways.
Yep. And vision as well for a bit. So mom alludes that it was light and stuff, but they did the clap test and then he's like, oh, she has hearing, like she'll be fine. Like, and stuff. So mom was like, okay. And within, I want to say, I think a month later, she came back and at this point, she was like, okay, I am requesting as a parent, I need a hearing screening or I need a psych exam for myself because I'm crazy.
Well, I honor your mom. Yeah. Like that, I mean, to fight and advocate in that way in healthcare, not only, I mean, people are learning now to advocate for themselves and their children. But before, I feel like in 1993, that was not even a thing to advocate.
No.
What the doctor said was what it was.
Yeah. And I would agree with that. And, but he was empathetic and he was kind. He was like, okay, we'll get you a hearing screening. And then of course she was glad that she followed her gut and hearing screening came back, but I was actually misdiagnosed.
Really?
Yes. And that's a whole another part of our story.
I was about to ask, like, how do you even do a hearing screening on an infant? Because they can't tell you if they can hear something.
It's called an ABR. And I would highly recommend working with an audiologist to understand that. Uh-huh. But it's what you see. ABR, I can't remember what it stands for exactly, but it's called ABR.
Okay.
And there's another test called OAE. Those are the two primary hearing tests, but they test how the ear responds from a nerve standpoint. Does that make sense? And simple, it's not painful, but the baby has to be asleep.
Oh.
So we tell people and to prep them for their hearing screenings. And this is what I've worked with my audiologist friends. It's ideal to let the baby starve and then feed them. We get to the office, they fall asleep post-feeding.
Gotcha.
So that way they can be still enough for the, ABR, auditory brainstem reflex.
Okay.
So because we have to look at the reflex there and that's part of a hearing loss assessment.
Right.
On severity of hearing loss. And it helps define what type of hearing loss as well. So.
Okay. So then you get the hearing screening. They find out, well, you just said you're misdiagnosed. what did they misdiagnose you with?
And this is where I stand that there's a difference between an adult audiologist and a pediatric audiologist. So the audiologist we saw was somebody who primarily saw adults and maybe 5% of the time pediatrics. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And there's certain telltale signs that you see in an infant that you have to look for in terms of body language and reflexes that you would see in an adult.
And I can attest to that because that is the one reason I chose not to do family practice. And I went acute care gerontologies, which is 14 years and up, because children to me are the hardest thing. They can be crying. You have no idea why. They can't tell you. And I'm just like, I don't want to miss it. I don't want to miss it.
My friends are pediatric. they have the whisper.
They do.
You know what I'm talking about? Like, it's just testicle touch.
It's innate. It's innate in them. They were born with it. And I'm just like,
I'm so thankful for them. But yes.
Yeah. I'm like, thank God somebody wants to do it because I cannot.
Yeah. So, so fast forward, I guess, to help us with when I was appropriately diagnosed. So, one of the reasons that my family does a lot in the advocacy realm of nonprofit, which we'll get to that, is because my mom fought tooth and nail basically for the services and that I needed and everything, because, she took the time to do all her research on her own and figure out, like, what are my options if you have a child with hearing loss who, as at the time, quotation marks, deaf as I was, which was moderate severe, was my original diagnosis. And I said earlier, my actual diagnosis is profound severely deaf. So we did not find that out till we flew to Pennsylvania, and I'll get to that story. But
wow.
One of the things that people don't realize is when you have a child with a disability, regardless of the type of disability, your state is required to send an early intervention provider to you.
Oh, I didn't know
within
that.
Within that disability realm. And they're okay. supposed to help you navigate your resources, your options, and it should be unbiased.
Is that free?
It is free.
Okay, okay.
Yeah, it's part of state because it's federally funded.
Good.
Federally and state funded both. It's under federal law. It's known as Child Finder.
Okay.
And that may ring a bell for some healthcare providers when I'm talking about that. But it's called Child Finder. And it relates to law, especially Part C and ID.
Okay.
If you want to know, and some other things too. But so our early intervention actually came to my family's house, and my mom had done research and everything. And she understood that options would be is a child could have hearing aids and learn how to listen and speak. You can learn sign language too. There was different ways. There's total communication. Like there's a lot of options. So she did her research. So she was like, okay, she's like, and because she was a first generation American from Germany.
Oh, yes. Awesome.
So she grew up at a time point in Germany, and she understood language acquisition because she lived in Germany from ages 4 to 10. And when you look at the language acquisition windows, we know that earlier is better to be bilingual and different things.
Right.
And at the time,
but like America is the only country that does not teach bilingual at an early age. Every other country teaches 2-3 languages.
But it depends on the system, I think. Yeah. But you also have to look at other countries. They have a lot more different languages within the same country. True. And smaller borders. So
do we now. I feel like we should at least, minimum, learn English and Spanish.
I agree with that, especially in this country. Yes. So I agree with spoken bilingualism and bilingualism for deaf. But the problem is that a lot of people don't realize it's the services and supports and the system set up in place, which is the reason why America doesn't do a good job teaching is not capable at this point teaching a bilingual spoken language.
Right.
So what happened was with the earlier intervention provider is they came in and they told my parents, your only option is to send your child to the school for the deaf. And you go and learn American Sign Language. There are no options, no other choices for her. And mind you that the ENT that she was at when they found out they were deaf, they had told her to expect, the expectations were, your daughter will not pass a fourth grade reading level. She will not pass high school. You just need to accept that she'll sign. There will be no other options for her. So that was part of what fueled my mom's research. She's like, surely it can't be this only thing. Because that's the expectation. And that's still some of the expectations that we see today.
But I was about to say, but even like, I'm almost going to cry because like, thank God for your mom. Because if she had not advocated for you, I mean, you're a damn doctor. Like, like you went to school for physical therapy and like you're doing all this advocacy work. Like, that is, like, truly, like, I'm literally going to get emotional. That is amazing.
And thank you.
Mom is listening to this, thank you to her mom for, like, just being that advocate and pushing forward when somebody said no.
Yeah. And that no was a hard no to the point that when my parents had told them, they were like, okay, we would like to learn and teach our child spoken language because that's our natural language of the home. And that was the reason that we didn't learn sign growing up because it was not our natural language of the home. And my mom understood what it took. And we didn't have any resources up in North Alabama to learn ASL fluently.
And I was about to ask you that. Do you know, like, if let's pretend your mom chose to go ASL sign language, how long does that teach? Like, because obviously she would have had to learn that. Your dad would have had to learn that. Before they could even teach you that.
It's the way we see it. The way that when I work with families, I'm not an expert with American Sign Language. Mm-hmm. I want to preface that. But when I've worked with people who are teachers for the deaf, early intervention providers, it's like a coaching process. That makes sense. Yeah. So I would say a great comparison, like for some people think about it. Let's talk about a family whose main language is Spanish.
Yeah.
And they're trying to learn English. So for them, the child is basically in a program where they're learning English all day and then learning Spanish at home.
Right.
So if that makes sense.
Well, because I said I've tried to learn Spanish before on my own, like with these, and it took me a long time.
And for a child, because of language acquisition windows and stuff, we are more adaptable where we can learn quicker. That makes sense.
Yeah.
And the research shows there are some good research related to bilingual with listening and spoken language and ASL, even though people feel like it's very different. But if you think about coaching parents with language and helping parents understand, if your child wants a certain language, you have to do what it takes. And that's where the problem is. There's a lot of misinformation from both sides. I will absolutely testify that it's easy to do. but people don't take into account apparent energy and everything, which is exactly what my mom did. Because right. like in North Alabama, we did not have a resource for us to be immersed into the deaf community. And there was actually no like one-on-one classes at all. And that their solution for my parents to learn sign language was to send a instructor once a month to our house for only 15 minutes. And that's not language acquisition, because any type of language you have to acquire, you have to be fully immersed into the language.
Right.
Which is what my mom understood when she lived in Germany her life. So that was part of her reasoning. And the thing that made our story challenging for us is the early intervention provider basically told us, we will not support you.
Wow.
That was the direct words from them to us, because we were trying to pursue spoken language with hearing aids. And it wasn't my parents or anti-ESL, but they're like, we don't like the outcomes, because also the outcome for the school for the deaf at the time was fourth grade, reading level of graduating, and it still is today.
And where is the school of deaf?
It's in Talladega.
So then you would have had to have moved.
Yeah. Okay. Or it was a boarding school at the time.
Oh, so then
yeah. They would be raising me, and they wanted to raise
right.
me.
Right. Like, yeah. And your parents are like, no, I want to keep my child with me.
And it's okay. There's some families yeah. that move there, have a great community. Right. It just depends, you know, but it does kind of point out the systematic differences that you see sometimes, like, because learning to acquire a language and different things as well, if you don't have resources within your own city, which is what you should by law, that makes sense, mm-hmm. regardless of the path you choose, people have to do things to extremes or have to relocate often just to find the right services and supports for their child. And I see it all the time across the whole disability spectrum.
That's very
spectrum.
Sad. Yeah. That is very sad.
Yeah. So, and especially rural countries get, rural cities get way harder, because they're usually the only person or the only family that may have a child with a disability of any type of disability within the rural area. And I know families who drive like 3 to 4 hours to go get support.
And I was about to say, what about the cost has to come into play at that point? Because like, sure, if you're a family that could afford to move or to drive or to yeah. hire a translator, you're going to be better equipped versus someone, like you said, like what if someone's born in a poor community where they don't have a car, they can't drive yeah. somewhere, or
and that's all the layers of systemic yeah. issues as well. Yeah. And in fact, Huntsville did not have anything for speech pathology with the way that I needed it, and co-parents both, but we'll get to that in a second. So we found a wonderful speech pathologist who was willing to work with us, but she realized that, and she had guts even back then, that I was not diagnosed correctly. And because of her, I was wearing hearing aids. I was wearing the most powerful hearing aids you could find on the market at the time, which is very, like, I would say maybe middle ground today.
Okay.
That makes sense, because tech yeah. has improved, you know? And that speech pathologist looked at my parents and was like, I think you should go to Pennsylvania and do a 2-week immersive intensive auditory verbal therapy immersion, which is So auditory verbal therapy is a type of speech therapy, but I say there's traditional speech therapy where you're working more articulation and other important aspects. Auditory verbal therapy focuses on the need to learn your auditory pathways in order to acquire a spoken language.
Okay.
Which is known as listening and spoken language today. Yeah. Like, it gave the birth to that. But anyways, we end up flying all to Pennsylvania, and we got diagnosed by one of the best pediatric audiologists on day one. We sat my parents down day one. Wow. My parents had done this. They're like, okay, this is our Hail Mary, you know, we're already learning a few signs, we're doing some stuff, but this is our Hail Mary just to see, is spoken language actually a valid option? Because by this point I was 1.5. Mm-hmm. So I was still young enough, and they knew how important those windows were to make sure I have any shot at any language at all.
And I'm yeah. kind of dumb when it comes to like the milestones of kids. Cause
it's number one,
when do kids typically start speaking?
As young as, well, so speaking as in babbling and stuff, yeah. but it could be young as 5 to 6 months old and stuff, okay. but I need to check with that as I'm not a speech
Yeah, because I'm not, yeah, yeah, and I don't know the milestone since I didn't do family practice, but I know that some parents, like when their kids need tubes in their ears, which I know is different, they'll notice that they're like saying things that aren't like correct, or they're babbling longer.
Yeah, I can testify to why that is. I can hit on that.
Yeah.
One of the things that people don't realize with hearing tubes and stuff is, if a child has multiple ear infections, they're not getting quality auditory access.
Okay.
And I actually do see speech delay in children that have multiple hearing infections. But think about, if your ears are muffled all the time, it's a form of hearing loss. But people don't say it's a form right. of hearing loss. So that's something I like to really encourage my parents. Like, think about through the lens of, if they're not getting access to good auditory, then they're going to have a hard time acquiring it, or spoken language, if that's
Right.
Mouth. Yeah.
That makes total sense. And I'm loving learning all of this. So yes, please continue with your story. You went to Pennsylvania and they diagnosed you day one.
Dr. Don Bolberg sat my parents down and gave the news, like, I'm going to break this gently as possible to you. But one of the reasons that all the work that you've been doing, it's not been unsuccessful, but it's been challenging, is because your daughter's been misdiagnosed the whole time.
That's so crazy.
And that's when my parents realized that I was actually severely, profoundly deaf, not moderate severe. And that's a big jump there.
I was going to say, can you tell us briefly, what are the levels?
Are mild to profound. That makes sense. So
what can those people typically hear?
And you have to look at the banana. It's called a speech banana. And that's what I would encourage people to look at. Okay. There's something called the speech banana. And it can show you the ranges from low frequency to high frequency of mild to profound. That makes sense.
Okay.
So it's mild, moderate, severe, profound, like kind of four long levels.
Okay.
But and it's tricky. I can't just give you like a general answer, right? Because everybody's audiograms, that's what the picture looks like, and that's where the speech banana falls. It gives a better picture when you understand where the speech banana is, just where people are losing, because some people have normal low frequency hearing loss, but moderate high frequency hearing loss. Like, yeah, you have different variables. That makes sense.
I mean, it makes sense because your eyes are the same.
Like, I'm some just down the whole bottom. That makes sense. Yeah. And low and high frequency both. Like, I have no hearing low and high frequencies in the severe and profound range.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So then you were misdiagnosed. Your parents learned that. Did day one they give you an option?
And that's when we found out, the whole time that the state of Alabama did not tell us, there was a Copeland Center in Birmingham, Alabama.
Oh, wow.
So it took two years.
Wow.
And it took flying to Pennsylvania to find out our option in Alabama. And that's where a lot of advocacy stuff was driven, not just the newborn hearing screening aspect piece, but my mom, at her heart, you know, she was like, okay, like, that really was an informed choice in a sense. Like, we're actively exploring stuff and working together. And now, in defense of both, that Copeland Center had just opened in 1994.
Okay.
So it was very new, because implanting children with Copeland was a very new concept. It was considered experimental, mm-hmm. which is why a lot of people were not anti-Copeland technology, but they were hesitant, okay. because it was a new medical technology and there was no studies on the outcomes.
Okay.
And so I understand
sense.
The risk.
Yeah. It and makes like, sense. Most people aren't going to say, let's experiment on a child. You
exactly.
know, like,
and that's the risk that makes yeah. sense. So I understand part of the cultural divisiveness that makes sense was they were concerned about the severity of the consequences for children who were implanted and not given the appropriate supports and everything, which does happen. And that's where high quality audiologists who are pediatric and Copeland audiology specialists come
so
into play, because you have
difference.
To,
yeah.
you have to consider performance related that also work with speech pathologists who understand the principles of auditory verbal therapy.
Okay.
And what I see happens a lot is parents are not educated, on part of the decision of doing what it takes and how much therapy it takes to learn to listen with Copeland technology. And there's multiple systematic factors, I would say, yeah. to that. But there's also a frustration to me with audiologists, too, who are not willing to accept that Copeland need to be program performance. We're seeing a huge shift of Copeland mapping trying to be shift to look like hearing aid mapping. And we don't hear the same as hearing aids. And
okay.
it's really frustrating, because I had even had audiologists had told me at like professional conferences, like, you just need to suck it up.
Wow.
So I'm like, this is my hearing. This is my life, you know, and you can't tell me.
Yeah. I was about to say, like, hearing to not hear or to not see is a huge safety problem mm-hmm. for you.
Yeah.
So, and I can't empathize. Like, I can't, I always get these, is it sympathy or empathy? Anyways, I can't, because I don't understand what it's like to not hear. So that's like, good. I can sympathize with you and say that is so awful and so terrible. And why would, but like, to walk in your shoes, not even an audiologist can say, I know what it's like to not hear. So
that, unless they're deaf audiologists that have that right. too, and that's fine, you know,
but it's just, that is so crazy.
Yeah. And like, people have the choice to hear, and you can still be safe in a lot of ways, because several of my friends who are deaf that don't wear hearing technologies, they rely on vision or other means, you know. And
yeah, I'm just saying, like, we have to be careful. It's a safety. Like, if someone's behind you, I mean, I know you could probably feel and see.
I would say, with the way I hear co-parents, I do hear from behind me some, but it's more of a big parental vision feel. That makes sense.
Okay.
Like, I have a little bit behind, but not directly behind. So
okay.
That's things I just have to be aware of and stuff.
That's interesting.
But that's where, with families, when they're making the decision about home height technology, there's a lot of factors that go into that. And one of the factors being is where a co-parent center is. Because in Huntsville, Alabama at the time, they didn't have a co-parent center or an audiologist or speech pathologist who understood that. So me and my mom were driving to Birmingham 3 to 4 days a week.
Wow.
In the very beginning of our journey, just to get the services that we needed. And then my brother and sister are deaf too.
Really?
Yes.
So is it
hearing,
so
like, parents, recessive? Yeah.
Okay. I was going to say, so like, this is obviously a genetic thing.
Yeah, it is. But the chances of all three children being deaf is very slim.
I was going to say very rare.
And we just said it was just God's will for us. And it just led to a lot of our journey and the people we've made and connections that we get things.
Are you the oldest?
Yes, I am.
Okay. So then she already knew. I was going to say, then your mom kind of already knew kind of with you what to do.
Basically. And even though it was hard every time, of course, as a parent, you know. Not in a sense of perfect, but she just knew how hard the journey was for each of us. And so it's rewarding, but it takes a lot of hard work.
So you got your cochlear implanted.
My first one when I was 2.5 years old.
Okay.
And then I got my second one when I was 10. And that's a different story itself.
I was going to say, what goes into like implanting a cochlear implant? Like, is it true like you like implanting electrodes into the brain?
No, and that's the biggest myth. Right. A lot of people think it's brain surgery. It's not. Because it does anchor a little bit into the auditory nerve, but you're not brain stem. Like you bypass the brain stem, but that's where your part co-parent can see is making sure that you do have active auditory nerve if it's functional. And you also have to have a cochlea. So the cochlea was just like the little snail as well. It has to be structurally stable enough. And some people have misformed cochleas enough that a cochlear, the electrode can't go through the cochlea to get to the auditory nerve.
Okay.
That makes sense.
So there's
a lot of reasons for co-parent can't see of why somebody doesn't.
So there's definitely, like you said, layers of deafness where, so there are some people that are born deaf or maybe acquire deafness that cannot have a cochlear implant.
And they deserve to have all the opportunities that people with co-parents do too. That makes sense. And their own language, everything. And that's something I stand on.
Yeah. And is that where sign language comes in for them? Because or is there other technology that would work for them?
It depends. That makes sense. But if I'm looking at it from a lens of language, acquisition, acquiring both, or language acquisition, language nutrition, then their language is going to be a visual language. Okay. And there may be some technology supports, like I've seen people use like the talk table things. Like there could be a range of things, but it's typically be a visual or a signed language.
Okay.
Whereas ASL or C or TC, there's like different variations. Yeah.
Now, do you remember?
Usually, today we see people know quicker now. Does that make sense? Yeah. Then
they're noticing.
Did. Yeah.
Now, do you remember which I know you had your cochlear implant very young, but do you remember hearing for the first time?
No, I do not.
Okay.
With the first one, with the second one, yeah. Because when my second one, I had a soccer ball hit the side of my head when I was around 10 years old.
Oh no.
Broke my internal device. And we didn't realize it. And that's a story I've shared on my Instagram and TikTok, which I need to finish. But you get the gist of it, of how I remember to the day of how it sounded when it was failing. Like I can remember it very well. And then I got my left ear, which I was one of the first bio recipients in all of Alabama.
Oh, wow.
Like one of the first for both children and adults. So
that is so cool.
Very experimental still again, but I made the choice myself because I asked my parents when I knew my right ear was failing. I was like, okay, I have to do surgery on this side. Can I just get this side done? So I asked my parents, I'm like, everybody has 2 years to hear. Why can I not?
Right.
And that was legitimately why I wanted to, was because I wanted to see if I could hear better. And to me, I was like, everybody has 2 years to hear. So why can I not too? So my parents were very supportive of that. And they worked and ended up being a battle of insurance, unfortunately, but they supported my decision that. So I can testify to how it sounded with activation on my left ear. But the thing that people don't realize is, and that's where I feel like I have a bit of unique experience, because I was implanted young and learned how to hear with my right ear. the way I hear on my right side is very different from my left side.
Really?
Yes. My left ear is really my supporting ear. If I was to listen on this alone, my voice would change a little bit and I have a really hard time actually detecting speech.
And when you say this, like act like I'm shocked, but like, I mean, it's no different than your eyes. Like I have a friend that has like she's basically blind in one eye and like can see out of the other eye, and her prescription's so different.
There's some similarities with that, but I would say like the difference is with vision, and depends on the type of vision loss as well. So I think like, I'm trying to think of a good comparison. Think of it like muscles. Let's do it that way. Mm-hmm. So it's like when I have a friend who has a traumatic brain injury and they have lost use of both arms. Let's put it that way.
Right.
And if you look at their muscle testing and different stuff as well, you know, you can train over time depending on the type of brain injury.
That makes sense.
To regain strength. And they may regain full strength of their one side. But if you don't train the other side for a while and then you try to train again, it's never going to look the same.
That makes
sense. That's part of the reason.
That's a good analogy. Yeah.
And I get that. And that's where with the deaf community, sometimes we get frustrated getting impaired vision and stuff. That's not a bad thing, but it makes sense because they're senses.
Right.
So that's where the conception is. But people don't realize that the way you hear and the way your maps fire in the neuroscience level is it has its own mapping. That makes sense.
Yeah,
just
definitely
like your
vision
has your own map. So yeah.
No, I'm complete. No, thank you. Cause that makes
it's
total
confusing.
Sense.
And like, there's not a good analogy. So, but being a physical therapist, like I used to, I'm like, okay, that makes more sense to me because
well, being a healthcare provider, I'm like, yeah. And when you say that, because even if you like, let's say casted your right arm, it's atrophied compared to your left one.
Exactly. Because it goes back to neuroplasticity principles. If you don't use it, you lose it.
Right.
Which is why there's such a hot debate in the deaf community in general, if a child should even be implanted young because they can make the choice. I stand on the premise, it's a family's choice. A lot of these families, when they're making the choice to do this, it's usually informed. Now are there families who treat CoPoint technology as we slap it on and it makes our life easier? Absolutely. And those are the families that did not receive good education. And I blame the professionals for that often, to be honest, because there are professionals who do treat CoPoint technology as a cure. And that is what creates a lot of the divisiveness in the deaf community. And that's wrong because it's not a cure, because if I take this off right now, we'd be communicating differently. Like we have to find other means to communicate. Like I'm still deaf.
Right.
It didn't cure my deafness. It's just an opportunity for me.
Okay.
It's just a different way of having opportunity for me in my life. That makes
sense. Now, do you wear it 24/7 all day, every day?
No. I take them off at night to sleep, which is glorious. But
because then you're like, I could be anywhere, New York City, and I don't have to worry about y'all.
Exactly. But I wear them to communicate and stuff. So like if I have to have hearing conversations and conversations where I'm speaking and listening, then yeah, I'll be wearing for that.
Now, are you in a relationship?
Yeah, I'm married.
I was going to say, that would be also a time where if y'all are arguing, it's like, take it off, you ain't listening.
Yeah.
Be like, I can't hear you, sorry.
Yeah, I may have done that before where we get in an argument and...
That's
a joke.
A joke. I'm just saying, like, it's funny to think about.
I just looked at him and I was just like... But he's like, you can read my lips, which I lip read really well.
Yeah.
And I'm like...
Oh,
like, ears
of,
and no see.
I was like, speaking of lip reading...
Yeah.
COVID, wearing masks.
That was brutal.
Yeah, because like you obviously have your cochlear implant so you can listen. But
now I depend on listening as my mode of communication.
But then
and some
people who don't have it, either like if they did, which I know when I worked in the ER during COVID, a lot of our geriatric population who did have hearing loss, who don't like to wear their hearing aids, depended on lip reading.
And I still depend on lip reading. It just makes... the listening fatigue less worse me. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Because I'm using both.
Yes.
Versus if I'm just hardcore listening, I have a lot more listening fatigue because I have to work hard. So lip reading is for me, and it's also known as speech reading. They're interchangeable.
Mm-hmm.
But think about people forget that 94% of your body language, it's language. That makes sense. It's your body
verbal,
language.
Non-verbal.
So that's all
that. All of
it's
it.
Not verbal. So it's body language, meaning like
non-verbal.
What you do.
Yeah.
So that's where speech reading helps me a lot. But with COVID, you have the mask on and stuff and you didn't have your lips or like I'm not able to see like how your cheeks move, how your jawline moves. And people don't realize when you pronounce certain words, you have certain muscular patterns.
Okay. I didn't even think about that.
Yeah.
Like I didn't notice that.
And that's what speech reading. And so people are always like, what is speech reading really? It's not just reading your lips, but people don't realize like when I'm lip reading, I'm actually watching your whole face and I'm figuring out and putting the dots in my brain. This is how you pronounce a sound, so therefore this is the word.
Wow. And you have to do that very quickly.
It's just natural.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I did it, and that's where speech therapy helped me. Then some parts of speech therapy, auditory verbal therapy. That's probably why I developed lip reading over time, was a little bit of that as well.
Yeah. And I noticed that you posted something on your Instagram about the masks, like going behind your ears and your cochlear implant.
I had a lot of breakdown. Unfortunately, my left ear, I had to take a break from that. But we've been working hard with my audiologist, and she's exceptional. I've been with her for 25 years, which is amazing. But she's worked with me to help me get my left ear to work better for me functionally, like in terms of performance and stuff. But I did have to take a break because of mask wearing. I was getting like, so the new scars sit right behind your ear. Like okay. If you look like were to fold the ear over, it's like literally right behind the ear. On my ear, I have the old scar, which starts from like around the jaw and goes into the temporals, like head muscle, and comes here.
Okay.
And that they don't do it anymore because it's more invasive. So okay. They figured out how to do less invasive now.
Okay.
Anyways, but I'm just sensitive there. So with the mask, it was just pulling me a lot.
Gotcha.
And I did have clear masks for patients who were willing to wear them, but it was like more of a shield. It didn't really close off the answer, so that made people nervous, which I understand. And
right.
I'm providing healthcare to them. Like, they have the right as a patient to decline it. That makes sense.
Agreed. So, yeah.
And I respect that. We tried it. But man, that cartilage hurt because it was literally a shield, like pushing your nose down. I was like, this is not a good look.
So I know we got off topic there, but going back to when you had your second cochlear implant, yeah. You said you learned, like you heard completely differently.
Yeah.
How much work was that for you as a child? Like all ages of life, like having to go to speech therapy and
learn. It was a lifestyle. Was a lifestyle. So I did a presentation recently for a school district, and I would have to go back and calculate the hours. But just to give you a snapshot from ages, we'll say zero as when I'm infinite.
Mm-hmm.
0 to 4, I was in speech therapy 3 to 4 days a week down in Birmingham, Alabama, especially auditory verbal therapy on top of speech therapy at home, which mm-hmm. is so... When I say speech therapy at home, that was the stuff my mom was doing, was it was all play. That makes sense. But she was basically immersing what we had learned in therapy into home.
Right.
And then by the time kindergarten hit, I was still being pulled out for speech therapy 2 to 3 times a week on top of school, on top of stuff at home. And then by, I think, let me think about this. By second grade, we'll say second grade, it was more like 1 time a week.
Mm-hmm.
And because I hit all my milestones by a point. And when people don't realize that... because I was late identified and late intervened, even though my parents were doing anything I could. When I hit kindergarten, I only had a vocabulary total of 5,000 words.
Oh,
which is really low. I want to say, and people could correct me, but I'm pretty sure that the average vocabulary of a kindergarten is close to 25,000.
Oh, wow.
It's something like that. It's a
lot.
And
you were, and you say you were identified late, but you were identified at 1.5?
So roughly? I was identified at with hearing loss about 5 months old, but remember I was misdiagnosed, so that's why I say late identified, because we didn't have a true diagnosis till I was close to 1 to 1.5, and that's when we started the Copeland Candidacy process at the same time. And it took a whole year because I was not deaf enough for insurance, because the FDA at the time only had approved cochlear implantation for children at only profoundly deaf. But I was severe profound, so I was on the bubble, so that's why it took a whole year to get my surgery scheduled and be approved to get a cochlear implant at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that's where I kind of wanted to talk. So if it was picture perfect world, how would it happen now for a child to be identified, and when should they, or would you recommend that
they
start?
So there are recommendations right now.
Yeah.
Currently the states is trying to meet the 1-3-6.
Okay.
Which means that at 1 month old, you are diagnosed with hearing loss. At 3 months old, you are seeing the early intervention, and you have a plan established, and you have received your implication by that point, actually.
Okay.
If you are choosing implication, and by 6 months, you're fully immersed into the early intervention system.
Okay.
That is from the Joint Commission on Infant Hearing.
Okay.
And the new guidelines, which were passed in 2020, is now 1-2-3. So they're expecting that every state should, when a child realizes they have hearing loss, they're diagnosed by month one, amplified by month two, and early interventions by 3.
Oh, wow.
And right now, what we're pretty much seeing is a lot of people are falling through the cracks. And some people say it's lack of family follow-up, and there's absolutely some of that. But a lot of it is there's not enough people to provide these resources, and there's a lack there's a lack of resources overall too.
Would you say also, like, because I know I work in healthcare, and I think insurance is the bane of existence. I think we've let it get too far and too wide about getting things approved. Like, should someone be approved before they hit that severe level?
Well, I understand what you mean by the word severe level. So with progressive hearing loss, usually there's already discussions with insurance if they're looking at co-pendency anyways. But part of co-pendency is you have to have hearing aids and prove the hearing aids don't work.
Kind of like anything.
That makes sense. Yeah, where
you have to, like, you have to try this first before you can have this.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And I get the why.
To because me, I get it, but it's also spending more money in the long run because hearing aids aren't cheap either.
No, they're not. And they've gone up astronomically. And unfortunately, there were a couple of bills that had been tried to push through the federal government level to get more affordable coverage for hearing aids and cochlear implants, and they still won't pass. To say follow the money on that. But,
well, yeah, it's crazy to me because the only experience I have is like my geriatric population who is already on Medicare and on a fixed income.
And when they can't afford them. That Alabama Medicaid actually does not cover for audiology at all after age 22.
What? So if I wanted to go, like, let's say something happened, I can't hear, and I wanted to go have an audiology appointment.
There are no audiology coverage services and hearing aid coverage at all after age 22 on Alabama Medicaid.
That is insane.
Not Medicare, Medicaid.
Yeah, but that's still, because, like,
you know, people are like, wait, I'm like, Medicaid.
Yeah, but it's so insane.
And there's a lot of limitations for audiology care on Alabama Medicaid as well.
Wow. And are you, I know you do
a lot of... that's the state of Alabama, but from a national standpoint, across, it's pretty bad. And one of the things that people don't realize is on a federal level, audiologists are considered equivalent of a nurse tech. They don't have the practitioner label either. And that was one of the laws they were trying to pass this year.
But I thought they were called doctors. What?
That's why I'm smirking here because I'm like, yeah.
Wow. Okay. That is very interesting.
Yeah. So there's just a lot of layers. And I think that's one of the things I see when I work with policy making, different stuff. There's so many layers. I understand. I literally think of the meme of the guy with, like, the poster board with all the red lines and everything, him pointing. Like, it feels that way sometimes because there are a lot of layers to it. And I think, quotation marks, to get things fixed where everybody wins, because to make access win. That makes sense? Where everybody has equitable funding, equitable support for services and stuff for their language communication modality and their choice of amplification. If that's their choice, that makes sense.
Yeah.
It's going to take a lot of changes even on the federal level. And one of them is the audiologist provision as well. Because right now, I think there is a disregard of audiologists and I try not to feed it. I think I just challenge audiologists. You guys can be better. I know this, but because there's such a low expectation, I think of certain things, and most people think of audiology as, oh, you just go get your hearing aids, fit it, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody talks about how audiologists can help improve hearing performance.
Okay.
Which, if you really get to know audiologists who care about wanting to improve hearing performance, it's so much fun to talk about that. That makes sense.
I've worked with two that, like, they've truly, like, they've blown my mind on how they'll sit there and educate their patients, like, hey, you could actually do this or this or this, and they give them options, where I have seen some that are just like, okay, here's your hearing, bye.
And that's where I think that's where I tell that the audiology profession needs to start calling out and actually doing better. But I understand there's a lot of fear because with the whole deaf community, there's, like, I like to say two spectrums. There's elitism and there's autism. So autism is what you hear a lot more, which is the belief that people who have hearing loss should automatically be amplified and cured of their hearing loss with hearing technology.
Okay.
And that's what's considered autism. And there's a lot more layers to that. But I think there's been such a rise of people being called autists on certain things when there's actually not autism to me.
Okay.
That people are afraid to speak up anymore.
Okay.
That makes sense. So there's a little bit, and it's coming a lot from elitism, which is the belief that all deaf people should not have hearing technologies at all, and that their native language is American Sign Language, which is fine for certain families and stuff, but you can't mandate your life perspective, your choices on everybody else.
Right.
And it comes from the hurt of a lot of people don't realize, so there's oralism. And then there's auditory verbal therapy. And people make the argument that oralism gave birth to the auditory verbal therapy, but people don't realize the idea of oralism, which is teaching a deaf person to speak.
Mm-hmm.
They were trying to teach deaf people to speak without any hearing amplification.
Right.
Which doesn't work.
Right.
And auditory verbal therapy is focused on auditory amplification. And so there is a lot of argument and a lot of divisiveness on the community of, like, the definition of oralism, auditory verbal therapy, and autism and elitism in general. Mm-hmm. So
is that where it comes? Like, I know someone had asked a question about speaking about the, what's the word? Why did I just lose it? The discrimination mm-hmm. again in the inside the deaf communication, yep. like where there's like you who have a cochlear implant, you don't sign as much. You said you do know it, but you don't sign as much.
Yep.
And then other people who are like, absolutely not. You should only sign. Mm-hmm. So.
And then there's a mix of us in the middle who are bilingual because they want the option to be able to communicate with their child when their child can't hear for us. For me and my family, we just all lip read really, speech read well. So it just, that's like our visual communication. Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah.
But for, there's some children who can't lip read and speech read. And that's where having another language, which, such as sign language, benefits the family.
Right.
That's totally cool, you know?
Yeah.
And that's the issue with a lot of policy. Policy is very much politics as well. So a lot of the middle is not being represented well. And I feel like on social media, there is a lot of loudness from a certain perspective. And a lot of that perspective often states and chooses to continue to view that you're not deaf enough because you aren't the same way they've experienced life. That makes sense?
Yes.
And some, a lot also comes from hurt too, because like these adults who are in their 40s to 60s that were raised in oral schools where they were not allowed to sign, which is not right. That makes sense?
They weren't allowed to sign?
Yes. Like, and so the one of the things that people have to acknowledge to oralism history is that deaf people were told not to sign. And there was a bit of a thing for a while with auditory verbal therapy that professionals were telling parents, like, you can only pick one or the other.
Wow.
With the evidence. And it's because people didn't understand, we don't know what we know now.
That right.
Makes sense. But there's a lot of hurt there.
Yeah.
And so deaf people were being told not to sign, which, what is their language for them? And if parents have chosen hearing and sign language for the child, but then to make their child, quotation marks, successful with learning to speak,
mm-hmm.
they should never sign. So I get the hurt there.
Right.
And that's why there's a lot of divisiveness in general, because it comes from a lot of hurt that is valid and stuff. But I think one of the things that people don't realize is a lot of the hurt and stuff, to me, has continued in a way that is hurting people like us, as I mean, children who were born deaf, who were cochlear implants and stuff, who are more oral, but we've never been against the deaf community. Like, we've always wanted to be a part of them, but because there was actually agenda and propaganda that was pushed around the time I was born, that cochlear implant technology strips you of your deaf identity, therefore you cannot accept them into your deaf community.
But it doesn't. You're still deaf at the end of the day.
Exactly. And so I think people just don't realize there's so many layers to that hurt as well, that people haven't realized that the hurt comes all around both sides. That makes
right.
sense?
Do you think there's a little bit, some, maybe a little bit of jealousy there and some? Like,
no, I just think it's hurt. It's just that's the way they've known their life and stuff. Just as people with cochlear implants have sometimes a hard time knowing that there's other ways of life too. Does that make sense?
What about when you were growing up? Did you experience any of that discrimination with having it?
Yeah.
How did you, what was the experience like for you when you experienced it?
So for me, it was a couple of different instances. One of them, I had positive deaf culture experience where I did have interpreter and at my church and stuff, who did teach a sign class. And that's when I learned third, fourth grade and stuff. But I even remember with that experience and everything, they were awesome. They were super sweet. And they were very validating of my parents' choice and everything for me, because they appreciated the opportunities that I had
mm-hmm.
because I was mainstream and stuff. And they didn't have that same opportunity. And they appreciated I had those opportunities, you
right.
know. But they were even the ones that warned my family, be like, now know that not all people are accepting like we are. And like, I had kind of known that in the back of my mind. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say the most adverse one actually happened while I was in physical therapy school. I was testifying to our state Congress committee on education about a bill that just was not pro-family choice. And it was a bill that actually would create a lot more barriers for children who families have chosen hearing technology with listening spoken language,
mm-hmm.
and even if they were bilingual. And the bill was very mandating ASL, and people won't acknowledge that, but that's what the root of the bill was. It took away family choice, and there's a lot more layers to that. But I was testifying, and the interpreter stopped signing because he believed that I was faking my deafness and that I was a hearing person that my parents had chosen to implant just to show their agenda.
So they thought you were faking?
Yeah, they stopped signing. And so my audiologist, who's a fluent signer as well, stood up and started signing the rest of the way I was saying. So that way, and that was wrong to me because that was a hearing interpreter.
Well, number one, that wasn't to you. That was actually detrimental to the people who could not hear you.
Well, and all around, because he was also they were sighing and they were like, she can't be deaf. Like, there's no way she's deaf and speaks this well and everything. Like, they didn't even know that cochlear technology and
having... You're better than me because I would have taken my cochlear implant off right at that time and been like, say something because, you know, you're way better than me. But I guess if you're in front of Congress, maybe you shouldn't show your ass. Not if you're trying to get bills placed. but here, I'm all about like social warrior justice and I'm all about showing my ass too.
Across the whole spectrum. Like, we got to show up all together. And so that was what's most frustrating to me, the whole situation is... there was deliberate ignorance. It makes sense. Deliberate ignorance. Like, they really didn't know because certain systems in place were hiding.
I was like, that would have been the time to show Congress, like, look, this is the spectrum.
And that's why we all showed up.
Right. Like, you could be like, people could be like me. Like, they can hear and they can speak as well as I do because my mom advocated for me.
Or we just found their sources, but we had to fight tooth and nail. And that was the problem with the bill. The bill was actually not going to be equitable funding at all for all the spectrum, the choices. That makes sense. So that was more of the reason we testify and did support the bill because it really did create equitable funding.
Right.
And a lot of people don't realize if, and you can take the time to read and you can figure out how much funding is given to certain choices. And people believe that. And I feel like that's a misconception and it actually changes state to state. But in our state, our funding is about 1%. For cochlear technology and listening and spoken language choices for family for children of hearing loss. So I like to say follow the money a little bit. That makes sense. So it was frustrating. And that's today.
And how, so like even today, like, so if someone gets denied a cochlear implant, do they have to pay for it 100% out of pocket if they choose to?
Okay, so the 1% I'm talking about funding is from the state government.
Yeah.
So but, if you know, but related to insurance, it depends on your insurance carrier, but I do see increased denials just for... or very limited coverage is probably the better word. Limited coverage for cochlear surgery, and they'll cover for your first implant. But if you need upgrade, and that's one of the things that I work on an advocacy standpoint is being someone who was born deaf and implanted cochlear young, I have to cover the cost of that for the rest of my life. And that is something that people will try to use as a reason why people should never be implanted. But that's still wrong because it's not equitably, you know?
Right.
Like if we have a choice, we deserve to be able to have coverage for the choices that we have too and continue those, you know.
I agree. I get the 1,000%. Service. You know what I mean? Yeah.
As you have deserved the right to have equitably funding and coverage for whatever you need to communicate and do your work and everything. It's in a sense accommodations, but it's also healthcare as well.
That should just be a mandated law anyways in general. Like if this is your disability, it's a disability, there should be laws to protect like you said,
there's laws in place, but they don't really mandate enforce it. And that is a whole nother topic of disability history as well. and the systematic injustice that we see, especially in disabilities as well, because of ableism. Yeah.
Right.
So
now I know we talked a little bit about your childhood going into your physical therapy program and you graduated that. How long were you a physical therapist before you realized like, you know what, my true passion and my true calling is to do this advocacy work?
So I was already advocating with social media and stuff before I went to PT school. I just always had loved being the idea of healthcare, of working people and serving other people, because for me, it's about meeting people where they're at. And that translates a lot to advocacy. And that's where I do want to be clear is there's this perspective of me as an advocate because I represent a part of our spectrum, people automatically think that I'm anti everything else.
Right.
And it gets really frustrating. But the thing is, I'm not here to say what is better, but we need to meet people where they're at. And we need to show up for what they need at where they're at.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
And I'm glad you said that.
I came from physical therapy as well.
I was going to say that. Yeah. I'm glad you said that because I have a hard time even in my life when I try to advocate for others. Like I think sometimes I push it past of meeting them where they're at. And I'm like, you should be here. You should be here and try to get them to see my side. So I actually needed to hear that. So thank you for saying that.
Yeah, I get that. It's easy because of healthcare providing, but we live in it. And so part of disability history, if you want to know, is the medical model. And that's where the medical model treats everything as disease and cure. That makes sense. So, excuse me. So when we look at the medical model and everything, we're, that is to blame a lot of the ableism that we see in the deaf community.
Right.
Not deaf, a lot of ableism within the disability community overall.
Right.
You know, so, yeah. But to answer your question related to what got me into physical therapy in the first place, I've always have loved moving my body. I was a competitive soccer player.
Okay.
So I always loved moving my body and everything. And so I wanted to use my passion for moving everything. And I loved anatomy. I love watching how people move. Like, it's just, it's very natural for me. And so I went to college and stuff, and I did start pre-farm because I was debating on that. I liked chemistry, realized that was not for me. that was not for me. And so I started on my path for physical therapy and stuff. And I knew physical therapy, like, I could work with people who have amputees, because I always thought that was fascinating, like prosthetics and stuff. And that is kind of meeting people where they're at.
Right.
They've lost their limb. Now they're navigating having a life of a different disability as well. Mm-hmm. And that's why I appreciate it. I had thought about primarily doing neuroscience PT. So stroke, traumatic brain injury,
yeah,
all that. That was always fascinating to me because not of the science behind it, but it's in a way to me, it was a form of ministry for me. Like, I get to be people, meet people where they're at, and encourage them to go somewhere. But also, like, it's a small baby step process. And I think that's one of the things in the medical model, we go from A to Z.
Yeah.
But we don't think about A to Z between. That makes sense?
Right.
So that's where I really do appreciate the therapy profession in general, because we do a lot better. And that's where allied professions work great with medical providers, because we can help you guys figure out where that steps fall in between to get somewhere. That makes sense?
Yeah, I agree.
Does that make sense?
1,000%. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because even when I've worked with other people, they'll be like, hey, like, they might say, hey, they're not understanding you. Like, you might need to explain it in a different way, or maybe you should try this.
And it's meeting them where they're at.
Right.
But it doesn't mean that you're setting the bar low.
Right.
And there's that balance. So with advocacy and stuff, I mean, I've been deaf my whole life. I had to work through a while that I wasn't deaf enough, but I'm also not hearing, you know, most of my friends are hearing. So I lived between two worlds for a while. So there was a lot of that. And when I got to undergrad, I had other friends with disabilities, and I started to get more comfortable with my disability identity, but it was because I was finally out of my house, not necessarily out of the safety of my parents' house, but
right.
I'm like in the real world. I'm like, okay, there's more to me. Like, you know, I am deaf and because this is how
but
I have to live my life. That makes sense?
Yeah.
And so, and because I had to wrestle a lot with internal autism and certain things, but also just a lot that I felt the hurt of, I was never deaf enough for my deaf community. So I'm like, okay, then where does that put me at? Because right. when I'm teaching my friends and stuff, my friends ask me, like, not what you need, but they want to genuinely learn about my life and stuff and experiences as part of friendship. But recognize, like, hey, when we are roommates, this is what looks a little different than your hearing roommate.
Right.
You know, so... And advocating for myself and stuff, advocacy just became a lot more natural, because advocacy really is just storytelling. Mm-hmm. It's a way of educating, and it's also storytelling as well. And that got really natural to me. And at the time with social media, I was more of a fitness content creator, actually, in Huntsville and different stuff by the time I was in PT school. But I started sharing my deaf journey and aspects of that. So during PT school, I was already doing some advocacy work. I just wasn't doing it as much on social media.
Okay.
And that's when I had testified against the bill and stuff. So I was already doing advocacy stuff in the background, mm-hmm. sharing my story. But then I would say the tipping edge was that event.
Okay.
When I'm literally testifying, the interpreter stopped signing because he had believed I was deaf. And I was faking it. And I'm like, okay, this is enough, because I had a couple other experiences up to that point, sharing different stuff. They're like, but you're not really deaf. Like, you're hearing, you work with open technology, so you're not really deaf. Yeah, I'm like, okay. And sometimes it feels like, not in a way like I have to win, but like there's no win for us. There's right. really not a lot of safe spaces for us sometimes.
Right.
So I was looking, I'm like, okay, where can the safe space be created? But if nobody talks about how to create that safe space for all of us, it's not going to get there. That
right.
makes sense. So, PT school went through, which I have absolutely no regrets about that. I loved every minute of it. I thrived in grad school, which people say grad school was the worst of their lives.
But I actually did really good in grad school too.
I thrived in grad school. I loved it. And I'm absolutely thankful for all the skills I learned as a physical therapist and public health both. And so I finished PT school and I started working 3 years ago. COVID hit, or I guess I've been working for 3 years because of clinical and everything, but I would say 2.5-ish years officially.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But then COVID hit, you know, for all of us. Mm-hmm. And I had just freshly graduated out of PT school. And I took advantage because the patient caseload had dropped a little bit and took like almost every class to get my public health specialty.
Wow. Okay.
And so, because that was always fascinating to me, just how the whole body works, because with public health, it's a very much of a full body approach
yes.
to me compared to other aspects of physical therapy. I like that full body approach. I'm really into functional medicine as well.
Same girl.
Because autoimmune issues.
Me too.
My mom has autoimmune issues and my family is like genetic. So we've always been pro functional medicine as well. But anyway, so pelvic health to me was bridging PT and functional medicine as well.
Okay.
So that's where I got started. But, you know, in part of advocating, not just for my deafness stuff, I was also advocating for my patients.
Yeah.
So I got really comfortable advocating to doctors. I got really comfortable advocating to even insurance sometimes.
Good.
For why pelvic health was necessary. So it was more natural to me. And then, but I continued to see this trend of there really wasn't a safe space for all people and that are deaf and have different choices. That makes sense.
Right.
There really wasn't that safe space for all of us. And COVID hit and I lost all my visual cues with the mask and stuff. And like I was exhausted and I was finishing up my pelvic health stuff. So I was still working as ortho only. So I was seeing two patients every hour.
Wow. Okay.
With mask on. And I would go to work and I would come home, have enough energy just to cook and stuff. And my husband, like we trade shorts and stuff. We have a good balance. But Chris was like, you literally came home, had to take your implants off because you were drained from listening. And
I was going to say, that's something that we haven't talked. We've kind of briefly talked about it, how you said, even though you can hear, you still have to read lips. You have to, because I had asked you
when
before,
I need it. Right, so like my understanding of voice, and you don't have a very good articulating voice, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't like the word articulate. Like if you have a deep voice or a really soft voice or something, that I'm going to be really relying on your visual cues.
Right.
That makes sense.
And so like and then I asked you the question, like, do you listen to podcasts? And you were like, no, I actually get listening fatigue. And I was like, oh, I personally didn't know that was a thing that you would get listening fatigue if you're quote unquote hearing with a cochlear implant. So
listening fatigue applies to the concept across the whole spectrum of the deaf community, people who have hearing or choose to use hearing technologies. So think of it this way. This is the analogy I gave on another podcast, and it's one that resonates well. We all have iPhone batteries, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. When somebody is wearing hearing technologies, that's an app running in the background the whole time.
Okay.
But instead, maybe a few apps running in the background, like for you, because we have all our mental processes going. Like when we're listening, we're also comprehending, we're intaking information, we're analyzing information and stuff.
Right.
But we're doing all of that, but I'm doing all of that while also making sure I'm processing correctly.
Yes.
What did you just say?
Okay.
And also, did I actually hear right?
Okay.
On top of all that. So for me, I'm running with multiple apps in the background. So for me, and we'll use COVID as an example, we start fresh morning, our iPhones are all 100%. And by lunchtime, you guys may be at 50, I'm at 25% because I've also lost access to certain apps. Apps are not working because I don't have certain visuals and different stuff. Yep. So I'm relying more on listening energy to make sure I comprehend information.
And that's where I get confused in my head, like, which I guess I wouldn't have known if I didn't have this podcast, when there is discrimination within the deaf community, just because you are hearing, you still have to go through these.
Or because we have access to hearing, but we worked really hard to hear as well. We do. That makes sense.
Yeah. But you still worked hard and you still work hard every single day.
Yeah.
So to me, that is actually admirable.
It can be, but it's just our life. That makes sense. It's just how we live. It's just our life. That makes sense. Mm-hmm. So, because that's one of the things I work with is, a lot of disability people and myself, we understand because our lives are different. People view it as admirable and stuff. So that's where we talk about like disability inspiration. Mm-hmm. And it does come from good intents, but people don't realize that really it's just the way we live. So part of just educating. That makes sense.
Yeah.
And that's, it's a weird, but I get
and
it.
And I was saying like within that community and the discrimination to me, like, I guess I don't understand the discrimination when you still are having to do all the things that you are doing to get where you are.
Yeah. And then just as my friends who, native language or their primary language is American Sign Language. Mm-hmm. They are busting their butts all day long, trying to even find those resources and stuff to have people communicate with them. Mm-hmm. Because the rest of the world, we don't communicate with sign languages.
Well, when
and
I worked in the ER, I would have some deaf patients come in. And of course, we don't have any on-site translate. We only had Spanish.
Y'all usually be ERS, I'm guessing, but it's not reliable. And there's a lot.
It would freeze all the time.
But it's frustrating for them because they don't have effective language access.
Right.
Yeah, it makes sense. Effective communication access. Sorry. That's the word. Effective communication access. And that's very,
Right. So like that's the only kind of example I had. I would feel very like I couldn't do anything for my patient because I couldn't communicate with them.
Yeah. And like there's other ways to communicate, but that's where you just have to work with and ask the deaf person sometimes to be willing to write. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I think what happens in those situations, especially ER is a high stress situation. Mm-hmm. So sometimes when I feel like we're in the fight and flight mode, we just don't think as clearly, because with communicating, it does require taking a step back mm-hmm. to figure out how to communicate with someone.
Right.
You know what I mean?
So, well, I mean, like if you're coming in a trauma, how do you get that done quickly if you can't communicate? And like even not even just deaf patients, like even patients of other languages where we couldn't get the translator there fast enough.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's a very scary situation. And that's where I would love to see more healthcare providers of all languages. Mm-hmm. And I have a couple of friends, one especially who has CodePoints, but she's also fluent ASL and she's a nurse in Birmingham. And I know that.
Oh, that's awesome. Really awesome.
Yeah, I mean, but it's good because we need professionals who are bilingual in different languages too.
Oh, I agree. So, and I wish it was taught in like med school, nursing school. Like I wish that was part of the program. Like
I wish that there was basic ASL. Yeah. Like that is something that we have pushed for, and that there should be basic ASL in medical terms just for communication purposes. It would be 1,000%. Beneficial, you know? Yeah.
So going back to your advocacy.
Yeah.
With
PT, it was natural advocacy and stuff, but I started sharing my story more and started realizing, because there was a lot of policy stuff going on during COVID as well, that really, or prior to COVID, that wasn't benefiting. I'm trying to think. There was a lot of policy at the time that wasn't truly representing the whole spectrum of the deaf community.
Okay.
And calling for equitable funding and equitable representation across. That makes sense?
Right.
You know, so that was really concerning to me. And I was seeing also in certain states where this had been passed, there were already families being denied of the choice they had made previously.
Okay.
And no longer had access to their services and supports as well. Or they were having to fight a lot more for it.
Okay.
Because people were trying to view deafness as through the lens of one perspective.
That makes sense.
So that's where I started sharing my story, not as in a way like you're wrong, but there's more to us than just one perspective, but we have to got to start all working together.
Right.
And that's where a lot of my deaf advocacy started coming out of that. And so I just started sharing my story, just, you know, like, hey, this is just me. This is my experience as a CodePoint user. CodePoint technology is not perfect, but this is how I live day to day. Take it. But take what I say with a grain of salt. That makes sense? And that's like, really, and how story sharing.
Well, yeah.
Sorry, and then because families have the right to informed choice. They just have the right to know the whole spectrum of choices. Not
you're not saying my way is the right way. You're just saying this is my experience and learn about all the experiences and then choose for yourself what is the best experience.
And that's
why
I stand on. And I do agree with the deaf community, deaf culture. There are professionals who are, it's their way or the highway. And that contributes to a lot of hurt.
And I've seen a lot of doctors like that.
And we see that in, you know, medical field as well. So that's where a lot of this stems from. But there's policies and laws trying to be made based on one perspective. And it is politics in a way. So that's where I started, but really it's story sharing, you know, so it became more. And then during COVID, I lost access to my mask. I was exhausted and everything. And that's why I started. And that's really, you know, me and my husband had been married for, gosh, only 2 years at that point. And I realized that it is my decision to how much I want to call myself deaf.
Yeah.
Because I was coming home, like, I am living everyday life as a deaf person, as a deaf physical therapist, and people were trying to tell me for a long time I couldn't label myself as that because I wasn't culturally deaf enough. But I'm also like, that these are the same people who do not want to acknowledge that I am a part of this community, and that's literally the straw that broke my back.
Yeah.
That, like, it was enough, and I'm going to start sharing my story because it's not just one perspective. But, you know, I've lived my life, like, I have faced discrimination too. I faced discrimination all around. Mm-hmm. And, like, I'm fighting tooth and nail trying to get the support that I need and everything.
Not only for you, but for everybody.
Keep fighting for you guys too, you know, but it takes two, and not two to tango, but when you tango, you're supposed to work together when you tango. You know what I mean? But it does take two to tango. Mm-hmm. So there's more than just this. And so I took time, and this is around the same time my mom had the vision for our nonprofit. She's our founder, and she asked me to start thinking about it and, like, looking over and praying about it, like, if I wanted to join her. Mm-hmm. So I was still working as a PT, and I joined her just to help her out and get it going. But then we continued to see things when I started working more in special education, where families were being denied the services that they needed in school districts. And my mom was doing a lot of that, but I was learning a lot from her, and I realized that, like, it's been natural for me to advocate like this, you know, and I am so thankful for my mom and my dad too, but my mom especially, because I'm such a, quotation marks, successful advocate because of my mother, because she model for me of what advocacy looks like in the trenches.
Yeah.
Like how you can speak the truth in love, but you stay in your lane, mm-hmm. or in the sense of you hold the ground. That makes sense.
Yeah.
But it was all that. And I realized that there needed to be people like me sharing our stories to show that you're not alone either.
Right.
That makes sense.
Yes.
So that's really the vision of everything my mom had experienced as an advocate and just multiple stuff of policy. And that's her story to share. But basically, during COVID, I would like to say there was a couple of different things that were occurring that time. That was basically the straw that broke all our back.
Yeah.
And led to the formation and creation of what's known as Center for Advancement of Next Gen Deaf. Because in order to promote policy and to protect deaf people across the whole spectrum, which is next gen deaf, promoting the next generation of deaf people means that we also have to get together. Like there is a seat at the table for all of us, and because there's nothing about us without us all.
Right.
And like the emphasis on the word all, that makes sense. And,
right. What I'm learning in this podcast is like, obviously there is so many different languages within the deaf community.
There's just a lot of layers, and there's a lot of systematic issues, even on state levels across the nation, to where, a certain state, you may have better resources for American Sign Language compared to listening spoken language. And then the other states, you'd have a lack of American Sign Language resources, but there's a lot of resources for listening and spoken language. Like, and it's all funding and stuff, you know, so I get it.
So like, with your nonprofit, what are y'all only doing policies, or are you actually seeing patients?
No, we do a lot of things. So, and that's, the question. So we did announce recently that one of our programs is Next Legacy Audiology. As a program, and we will be seeing patients starting this summer.
Oh, yay.
All things willing. But the beauty of that audiology clinic was open out of a couple issues that we're seeing, especially in the last year nationally and internationally, is one, co-point manufacturers are trying to shift programming into more like a hearing aid type of model, which is fine for some people, but they keep deliberately leaving out people my age, which we call legacy co-point users, because we were born deaf. Or we were implanted at a young age and we've lived co-parents our whole life. And a lot of the data keeps looking at ages 0 to 5. And they consider an adult co-point user to be anybody over age 60. Like the average age for adult co-point recipient is 60. They're not collecting data in the middle. They're kind of grouping us into adult, but we're pediatric co-point users that grow into adults. And the protocols don't match.
Right. If you have it, you should continue it. Does that make you nervous that they won't?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I was going to say, like, what if they take it away?
I'm like, you are changing my performance and my hearing.
Right.
And so are you about to take me to a point where I won't be able to hear my hearing technology? So I'll be able to access my job and other stuff that I need for access. So that's where that piece and collecting data is what we're going to do over time, mm-hmm. is to demonstrate, like, this is a population that you guys are deliberately ignoring. And we're seeing this on international scale. So I've worked with some other people with that. So that's one aspect. And plus, co-parent services are really not covered under insurance at all either. So
basically between ages 5 and 60, there is nothing. So what if I'm in a traumatic
here, but they don't really collect data with us. That makes sense.
So
they're just kind of pushing us into the adult category, and they're focusing on what people around 50s, 60s are saying in focus groups about what they want for their hearing technologies. But these are the people who've had hearing most of their life, mm-hmm. and become latent deaf, which is fine. That's just their life, you know, but they're hearing differently than we hear.
But what if you have early, like, I'm 30, I'll be 37 this year. Yeah. And what if something happens and I all of a sudden can't hear? So then I don't have access to cochlear plant technology?
No, you do have access, but what I'm talking about is programming. So So the way you have to be mapped a certain way to hear a certain way.
Okay. Yeah. Now
I apologize for the confusion.
No, that was me. I was just like, but even though mapping is part of the cochlear plant technology. That would make it.
So
still
it's basically
a
software thing. Yeah. They're trying to make it like, it easier for audiologists to program us, but they are not wanting to acknowledge, or I have felt they are refusing to acknowledge the sacrifice of who they're sacrificing.
Yeah.
Which is people who've been raised, and because it's a lot of layers, like I said, but with co-parent mapping, there's something called streamline mapping.
Okay.
But my map is so individualized and based on performance that the software will lock you out of stream mapping.
Really?
Protocols, because I don't qualify for it. And I have a friend who had moved to a different state who is like me, and the audiologist got flustered at her that she could not switch this person to streamline mapping because that's all she knew what to do. And that's where I go back to the audiology profession piece, that we have to start figuring out a solution altogether. Because
do you think it's the
and some it's manufacturer faults. Because manufacturers are training audiologists what to do.
I was going to say, so that's where I'm like, is it also like schooling? Like, I wasn't taught.
No, I wouldn't say schooling, because wearing to work with cochlear implants is a specialty.
Okay.
Just like I went to PT school and then I worked on my specialty as public health.
Gotcha. That makes sense. Yeah, that makes sense. Because I was like, is it because they're not learning it in school?
No.
And so they're afraid to learn something new?
No. Okay. But I would say I attribute to training, because certain cochlear manufacturers are really not, they're focusing on audiology from a geriatric standpoint.
Gotcha.
And young children, but they're not thinking about the life span. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So they're looking at creating technology. It's like, it's not all bad.
Yeah.
But the thing is, they're refusing to acknowledge a stakeholder group, which is us.
Because we have lived our whole life
and we'll face multiple revisions. And one of the things that people don't realize, cochlear technology was made in the mind when it first was created. Because it's an implantable device, they're looking at the lifespan of the device is going to live for 20 years.
Okay.
And so now we're seeing a lot more revision surgeries age group because...
Well, not only that, like, technology changes every day. They could come out with an implant tomorrow that's this big.
And people don't realize that the internal processor has to be... whatever they make externally has to accommodate the internal processor. But like for some of my friends, they basically have what is equivalent of an analog inside their head. Everything is digital.
Mm-hmm.
So they're having to have revision surgeries even to upgrade, or they will lose hearing.
Okay.
So there's a lot of layers to this as well. So with Next Legacy Audiology, we want to help support people, because switching and activating someone from an analog processor to a digital is a shock to your brain. And you have to be very sensitive. You have to program based on performance with that.
Okay.
And that's what happened to me at 10, because I was from a very older internal device model and was implant into a new one because that was the choice. That makes sense?
Yeah.
My audiologist knew that. And when we had to individualize my map in such an extent, so it did not feel like a shock to my brain when it was activated. That makes sense?
Yeah.
And that's where we have to have those customized tools. And they say it still is customized, but it's getting to the point that you can't access our customized tools that we rely on performance.
Yeah.
Does it make sense?
Yes, that makes a lot of
sense. Because people are afraid to work with complex cochlear patients, which is what us... It's what we are. We're complex because we've been living it for our whole life, but we have to advocate for that piece. That makes sense.
Yeah.
So that's part of Next Legacy Audiology's objective. And the other objective is pediatric hearing aid fitting. And then because we have a huge wait list for people who need pediatric hearing aids and stuff, and children, they grow fast. So we can talk all about that. And then hearing screenings. There's a lot of children that are not having a second hearing screening because the wait lists are so long. So there's a lack of follow-up. But that's like the primary purposes. We're just trying to help service, not service, but we're trying to help fill the gap that we're seeing basically in North Alabama and nationally related to cochlear implants, and providing hearing services and quality hearing services and audiological care to families who are next gen deaf.
So starting that clinic, how many audiologists do you hope to have at the beginning?
We already have one. It's our director of audiology, and she's, her name's Dr. Lisa Hall, and she's, finishing developing our entire program as well for us. But
so how can we as the community help y'all grow? Like, let's say in 5 years from now, y'all have 50 audiologists in there and people are,
love that.
But I'm just saying like people are, but I'm just saying like people are flying from everywhere around the world to your clinic. I mean, that would be the goal and the hopes and the dreams.
Well, and we have a secret that we'll hope to reveal where maybe people don't have to fly for us, but we have some things in the works that to make ourselves accessible as
possible. Can we donate to your nonprofit?
Yes, you can donate to our nonprofit right now, but we don't have a donation leak up because we're waiting for our tax exemption for IRS. That makes sense?
Yeah.
But it just takes time with the government right now, but we're developing, we're treating it ourselves right now as we can. We are acting right now like we know people need this stuff, so we're working right now.
Okay.
Yeah, because then the flip side, and that's where I would just say, just watch our social stuff. If you want to support us financially, we absolutely love to have that support as well. On the flip side, the other thing we do is advocacy work. So we do a lot of education with teaching parents about what their rights are. How does it look to have an IEP for a child who is deaf and hard of hearing with hearing technologies that use listening and spoken language? How does it look to have an IEP or a Section 504 plan for a child who's bilingual? Like, that's the thing. Does that make sense? Like,
yes.
You have to be very careful with the wording stuff. But the goal of our advocacy program is to create a collaboration between families and school districts. Often schools view a parent who knows their rights as a threat because they're more difficult to work with. And that is false to me because those parents are really difficult work. They just do understand the rights.
Right.
but like there can be some common ground. And
I was about to, what do you see? Like, do you, like, so in our community, are you going to the schools to teach them, like, how?
No, okay. Not this time, but we teach parents, so parents come to us, and okay. We provide consulting services and stuff.
Okay.
Where we'll walk through the IEP process and stuff, and usually, because we're usually working with families who are in the trenches, so the school has denied them of their right, they're trying to avoid due process, so it's actually a great tool to use an advocate outside. The parent has the right to bring anybody they want to the IEP meetings.
Okay.
And it's 504 meetings. So some parents will bring an advocate in to try to help remedy the situation.
That makes sense.
So we're not attorneys, but we basically work on creating paperwork and different stuff. So that way, if it goes to due process, we recommend our families to attorneys that we have established relationships with to help navigate the situation. But we're basically like a Hail Mary in a sense to try and remedy the situation. So my goal is collaboration. Okay. And because we have to build capacity somewhere within the school systems to create resources and stuff, like I want to be able to work with school districts, not against them.
Yeah.
So that's also the other part, I would say, of a lot of what we do our nonprofit. I'd say
that'd be really cool if the schools actually could bring y'all in and just
I have lectured before on listening spoken language. I have. And we've created some good relationships recently out the fruit of all that.
Because then they could just reach out to you if they're like, hey, I have this deaf student and I don't know what I'm doing. Yep. Can you please just help me?
And that's things that we do as well, too. Yeah. So that's part of the APSE program. So. Okay. And but you can basically say our nonprofit at this point that's currently is the two programs I just share. We want to serve next gen deaf through our clinical care and different stuff through that. And then we also work with advocacy services as well and support. Like we're just here for all. That makes sense.
Yeah.
And through all that, it does shape some of the public policy that we do. That makes sense.
That makes a lot of sense.
Because we have lived, we see lived experiences. We're not collecting data, but we're able to carry from like, here's what's actually going on.
Yeah.
And here's a solution, but here's what's going on too. Does that make sense?
It does. And I appreciate all of this information. Like you said, it's a lot of layers. You've lived it your whole
life. It's like a cycle. Yeah. That makes sense.
You've lived it your whole life. So you can say it's easy for me to educate, like, but even just so like if someone is listening to this podcast and they're like, I want more information, how do I learn to be a better advocate for the deaf community? Where would you tell them to go?
A couple of things. You can check out our website just to see what resources and stuff. We have a couple things there. The biggest way to connect would be our socials. So you can look at my Instagram directly because I do a lot on Instagram and posting and stuff on my personal Instagram, and that's just.h squared. And then our nonprofit Instagram, which is linked on my Instagram, is CanGDef, which is CANGD, and then but where the D starts is the word deaf. So that's how you can find us a little bit to learn more. And because really the future of advocacy and educating is social media.
Yeah, it is.
And that's something that I'm working as an executive director to really get the word out there. That makes sense?
Yes.
And being a nonprofit, we believe in transparency too. We understand that nonprofits are under scrutiny and nonprofits don't use their funding well. But we want to demonstrate through our social stuff that we acknowledge this and we want to be transparent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, so. I appreciate all of this information. Like your story is just, I know you say like admirable is kind of like the not word to you. I find you admirable.
I appreciate that. Because, you know, like we can talk about as friends to friends. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. I'm saying I find you admirable just because of the work you are doing.
Yeah.
No, I don't find you admirable because you're deaf.
And perfect. And that's the way to say it. That
like,
makes sense.
Yeah. I find you admirable because the work that you're doing and the policies that you're putting in place, like that is not even something that I would have even thought of because I am hearing. So I find you at like you're so young and you're speaking to Congress. Like, I mean, that is admirable. No matter in what sense you're doing that.
This is the biggest thing I like to leave people with. 1 in 4 people will have a disability in them sometime in their life. 1 in 4.
Yeah.
And out of that 1 in, the last stat I saw was 1 in 9 will have hearing loss at some point in their life.
Wow.
And that's US alone. And that's worldwide as well. And it's predicted, I think, by 2050 that 1 in 2 people will have hearing loss.
And I know we hear it more like with hearing aids and geriatric populations because we all have grandparents that their hearing has decreased over the years. And I shared a personal story with you before the podcast. And I don't care. I'm a very open book. My grandmother, who was tragically passed away in a fire in her house, the fire started on the opposite end of her bedroom and she had severe hearing loss, but she was denied hearing aids through insurance because she wasn't hearing loss, like she wasn't deaf enough
at the time.
And so we don't know if this would, I mean, everything's in God's plan, you know, but her neighbors were yelling at her bedroom window for her to wake up to get out of the house and
she passed away.
Yeah, she passed away in the house because she couldn't hear them.
And that still happens today because what things that should be accessible is like the smoke alarm stuff. We have to pay out our pocket.
Right.
Like, to make sure that we're safe, too.
Well, and that's a whole other thing. I was going to say, I watched a show on ABC. It was called Switched at Birth. I don't know if you... And I loved that show. But, like, just even seeing things that I wasn't privy to, like, when they were sleeping, like, when you take your cochlear implant out at night, if your husband's not there, like, you may have to buy different devices where things flash or lights show. And that's something that we don't even think about or take for granted just because we're not used to it.
And that's where... that's the reason I was saying the stats earlier. People don't think about things until it affects them.
Right, right. And that's across any spectrum.
Exactly. And that's part of what I'm really enjoying. I like to say right now, we are in a huge advocacy surge right now, just across the whole spectrum of different things from sexuality to race to disability. There is this huge advocacy era going on right now that I think it's really important. And one of the biggest points that all a lot of us have been driving home is people don't want to acknowledge things because it does affect them.
Right.
That makes sense. Or it doesn't matter to them until it affects them. So, yeah.
Well, going back, this is kind of, I mean, I always try to relate things in my brain. I used to get in trouble in the ER a lot because my aunt calls me a social justice warrior. Like when things weren't affecting me, like let's say a coworker got in trouble for something and I thought it was unfair, I would go to the boss and be like, this was unfair. Why did you treat them like that? And then I would put myself in jeopardy and in trouble. And my aunt was like, you've got to stop advocating for people. But I said, I can't. Like it literally affects me to the core when other people are getting reprimanded for something that is unfair and unjust.
Yeah.
I was like, I just can't.
So but I also don't appreciate handle social injustice because I get it.
I also don't handle it as well as you do. I might be very more unprofessional. Professionals.
I've learned how to bite my tongue. Like, I have there's not. A time and there's a place.
That's something but I need I'm you not to teach
afraid
me.
To threaten with I love it. The right things. Right. Example, I will not name names, but I threatened a secret committee that was trying to make decisions on deaf people that if I was not on it because there was a lack of equitable representation on this committee and stakeholders that he intentionally left out, that I had a whole plan. I wrote them a letter and everything. It was a very strongly worded letter. I emailed everyone they had excluded, including the people in the community.
Yeah.
And I also went and I talked to someone I knew up high within Alabama who encouraged, you probably should acknowledge this.
Yeah.
And it got resolved. But I had a plan. Like, if that didn't work out, I was going to send another letter to the next higher upper. And if he didn't respond, I was going to go to the media.
Yeah, so there you go.
I will raise hell.
I love it.
I will raise hell eventually.
Well, I appreciate you educating me and the listeners on everything.
Thank you.
Something I wanted to mention that you brought up, and I never even thought about it, just this, again, transcripts for podcast. Yep. How if they're not there, someone can't acknowledge your podcast, listen to your podcast. So I'm going to start working on that for...
I recommend.
Yeah. And I appreciate you.
The future is accessible, you know? Right. And when people are actually accessible, their things, they actually get more, not doing it for the following, but you'll have more people who wants to engage with you because... You're meeting their needs. Does that make sense?
Well, that's just something simple.
Yeah.
Like something simple that I could do to help.
And to be honest, a lot of accommodations are actually simple and people don't realize that, but there's such a fear about how expensive things are and how all those things, but the things we've been paying for the price of accessibility in our entire lives. Right. So it's, yeah.
No, I appreciate all of this. Thank you so much.
And thank you for having me.
Pimp yourself out one more time. Where's your social media? Where can people find you?
You can find me on Instagram and TikTok, but I would say go with Instagram because that's where I'm a lot more active. It's jess.hsquare. So jess.hsquared.
And they will be in the show notes for sure on a clickable link. You can definitely follow her. Guys, go follow her content. She, number one, not only you're beautiful, by the way, like when you mentioned earlier, you were a competitive soccer. I was going to ask you because you look like you're into fitness. So gorgeous girl. You thank won't you. Like, and her content is awesome. She's funny. She's amazing. Just go follow her and donate to her nonprofit.
All right. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you guys. Until next time. Bye.